Welcome to Series 3 of The Great Humbling. What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to be less proud, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, ground, to be grounded, and humilis, brought to the ground, made low or lowly. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a poet, futurist, and recovering sustainability consultant. In the early days of the pandemic, I started recording these conversations with the author Dugald Hine, where we wonder together about the strangeness of the times we're in, the altered states into which they push us, and now, in this third series, the new moves that might be called for, if these really are times of being brought back down to earth.
Here we are. It's May already. At the end of the last episode, I did something I never do. I said, we'll be back next week. So, of course, we ended up taking a mid-season break. Thank you to people who sent in messages saying how much you were looking forward to the next episode. Sorry we kept you waiting, but here we are. Ed, what did you do with your week off?
Well, I'm not sure it was a week off. I've been moving house, so I'm now in the mill of impermanence, perhaps hopefully permanently. And the local shopkeeper asked me yesterday if we were settled in yet. I said, well, we can eat, wash and sleep. And that's all that matters right now. And I was certainly relieved when you mooted a week's break. It's hard to be focused on humbling when you're fumbling with your life's possessions in a myriad of partially labelled boxes.
Yeah, frankly, I'm surprised it was me who suggested taking the week off. You know, moving house, and I say this as someone who has done it recently enough that I haven't yet erased the memory of it. It's one of the more stressful experiences of life. But I have a question, Ed. How do you sleep at night with all that peace and quiet after, what is it, 25 years living the top of Brixton Hill?
Yeah, well, I did stand on the back deck the morning after our first sleep here. And I was balmed by birdsong, and I thought to myself, why the hell haven't I done this sooner? But as we all know, timing is everything, and I'm sort of trusting the synchronicity of stewarding this unique place right now. And last night we had blustery 40-mile-an-hour winds, and it was really wet and wild out, which gave the wooden building a proper galleon-like feel. And the burble of the River Chet under the mill became a more insistent rushing of water down the overspill, which goes under the kitchen floor due to the extra rain. So it doesn't feel much like May Day, this Beltane, but there's certainly a sense of transitions and shifts and flows and dare I say it, a cleansing of some sort.
So I spent the week catching up on the preparations for Homeward Bound, which starts next week. So that's the sort of series where over 7 weeks or so we'll be gathering. I'll be teaching from the stuff that shaped my life, my thinking, and the people whose work has helped me find my bearings, tools that I've ended up coming to trust in bringing projects into being. There's still places available, so if that sounds like what you need this spring, then check out the School Called Home website. But apart from that, I also found the extra brain cycles freed up by a week off from podcast making to notice something that's so obvious. It seems absurd that it actually genuinely came as a surprise. But it did, just looking around and looking back and seeing how my work these days has come to orbit around the future.
Yeah, well, the future catches up with all of us in the end, my friend.
Well, quite. I mean, this spring, I'm doing this podcast with you. You're officially a future naught. And I'm translating Cartan Averroes, the audio walk app play from Rikstiaten that I talked about last series that, you know, starts with the question, how do you feel about the future? And I've been doing a project with the National Artists Association here in Sweden about artistic livelihoods and their long-term sustainability, where long-term is the kind of key word there that propels you into thinking about the future and change and Last week, I did a lecture for the Sustainable Economics Futures Program at Uppsala University. The week before, I did a seminar for collaborative future-making researchers at Malmö. I've been taking on two different trips to the future over Zoom this spring as part of the Transition Stories project with Reach Investment Land. The list goes on. But there are two things here. First is it's actually really clarifying to notice this common thread in the weird mix of activities that I get to call my work. And second, there's a problem because I don't really believe in the future. I think that the kind of processes in which we're invited to create a vision of a better future, to manifest a new story, to imagine a sustainable world and how we got there, I think these are all part of the problem. I don't think that looking towards or talking about the future is actually helpful right now. So by Thursday night last week, I'd started writing about all of this and I had a title, Instead of the Future, because that seems like a reasonable thing to write about if you wake up one day and discover that you accidentally became a futurist.
It happens to the best of us.
Indeed. And by Friday morning, I'd started a big thread on Facebook about whether or not to reboot my newsletter and move it to Substack. And if I do, then that's where I'm going to write about all of this. But I think the moral of this tale is think twice before taking a week off from your existing projects, because you might discover disconcerting things about yourself. How did you wind up as a futurist, Ed?
Well, accidental futurist is not a bad explanation for me either, actually. Yeah, maybe the devil makes work for idle minds, Diggle. And for me, it was two things. A sort of frustration with the notion of sustainability, which was begging the nagging question, well, sustaining what precisely? You know, this. And then a slightly more self-interested personal repositioning to get more speaking gigs, as people seldom got excited about booking that sustainability guy. But if you rebrand yourself as a futurist, then suddenly everyone's interested. Like, you might have something more important to say, even though I was essentially saying the same things. And my fellow future, or close sailor of the winds of change, Mark Stevenson, always calls himself a reluctant futurist rather than an accidental one, as he can't stand most futurists who can tend to that two haircuts on the same head techno-utopian cliche. And we're both very clear that, unlike many futurists, we don't do predictions. We don't do the extrapolation of trends and all that systemic soothsaying that seems to be where many focus. And we try to stretch the imagination of the possible, although he's way more of an empiricist than I am and far more into prog rock, which isn't hard. And I hear you on futurism being part of the problem, which is, I guess, it's probably why we ended up finally having that long overdue Skype call last March, possibly about a decade too late, or maybe precisely at the right time. Who knows? But that's why we're both here now, cud chewing over the North Sea together from an old cobbler's in a mill. But futurism aside, isn't it about time we gave the listeners this week's instruction?
Indeed. After Douche Rooms, the episode so potent we had to take a week off, this week's instruction is C double.
That sounds like a side effect. Well, I'm going to take you from the mycological to the etymological, and in this case, the medical definition. So seeing double, or double vision, or in the scientific term, diplopia, is the simultaneous perception of two images of a single object that may be displaced in various different planes, horizontally, vertically, diagonally, i.e. both vertically and horizontally at the same time, or even rotationally in relation to each other. So does that sound confusing?
Yes.
Yes. Interestingly, double vision is often voluntary. So some people are able to actually consciously uncouple their eyes. Now, we've all done this either by over-focusing closely, or perhaps on a finger in front of your eyes, otherwise known as going cross-eyed, or just unfocusing, sort of letting your vision soften as you relax the muscles. And double vision is neither dangerous nor harmful and may actually even be enjoyable. It also makes viewing stereograms or those magic eye images possible, which also makes me think of Thundercats. Sword of Omens, give me sight beyond sight. And I've thrown that one in there basically for a regular listener and one of my former Futera colleagues. the slightly younger Mr. Ollie Lauder, who wrote to me after the start of Series 3 saying, "Oh good, I get to listen to a whole bunch of obscure before-my-time cultural references that I then have to go and Google." And ironically, he's actually a little Nathan Barley himself. But I did a Google on Double Vision, as I do, and I stumbled upon a movie of that name from 2002, which featured a serial killer who impregnates victims with a black fungus that causes hallucinations and compels them to kill themselves. So don't do these kind of shrooms, people. And the plot of the film was actually based on a Taoist belief that to become a Shan, an enlightened immortal, one must endure the five sufferings: frigid hell, fire hell, disembowelment hell, heart extracting hell, and finally, the pièce de résistance, tongue removal hell. Sounds lovely, doesn't it?
Hieronymus Bosch, eat your heart out.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought Taoism was all gentle stuff about being like water.
Yeah, but diplopia can also be one of the first signs of a systemic disease, particularly obviously to a muscular or neurological process. And it may actually end up disrupting a person's balance, movement, or even reading abilities. So it got me thinking, like, is our double vision the manifestation of a systemic disease? Because there's something here about the duality of vision. And I say this as someone who is actually effectively blind in one eye. This is a result of an extremely foolish teenage experiment. Keep it foolish. When I was playing with an explosive starter pistol pellet, trying to make it go bang, which it did, and led to several pieces of metal embedding themselves in my eye, which caused a traumatic cataract and retinal scarring. So I had a night in the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital's specialist eye ward, which seemed to be ironically dubbed Nelson Ward after the legendary one-eyed admiral, which I thought was in slightly poor taste. And then a week of tutting consultants declaiming my stupidity, although they were actually probably right, at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. So I've seen the world through one eye for the last 30-odd years, which means I can't see stereograms and 3D movies are completely wasted on me. Now, I talk about this because we're obviously binocular beasts, but there's actually a lot of mythic significance to the idea of the transcendence of a single eye. We may be familiar with the Erasmus-derived proverb, "In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king." And the Norse god Odin is famously, or perhaps infamously, one-eyed, which, as the mythology describes, is as a result of an adventure to Mimir's Well. Mimir's Well lies amongst the roots of Yggdrasil, the Norse world tree, which sits at the centre of their spiritual cosmos. Now, Mimir, or Rememberer, is quite an interesting character too, because he's been there happily quaffing away at the waters of the Well of Fate, and as a result is exceptionally wise and acts as a sort of counsellor to the gods, specifically around the honouring of ancestral traditions. So he's definitely not a futurist dude. And so when Odin rocks up asking to drink from the well in his pursuit of wisdom, as the well's guardian, Mimir is fully aware of the value of his request. So he demands an eye in return. And we don't know whether Odin prevaricated or whether he simply went for it, but ultimately he gouged out one of his own eyes and dropped it into the well as an offering in exchange for this wisdom. And there's a huge symbolism around this perception, you know, this swapping of one form of sight or seeing for another. And Odin effectively swapped the everyday profane perception on the outside for the rather more profound perspective of something more sacred on the inside.
So what comes to mind for me when we start talking about all this is some lines from William Blake from a letter that he wrote in the form of a poem. And at the end of it, you get these lines. "Now I a fourfold vision see, and a fourfold vision is given to me. 'Tis fourfold in my supreme delight, and threefold in soft Beulah's night, and twofold always. May goddess keep from single vision and Newton's sleep." There's a lot packed into that, so let me just try and unpack it, because what you're getting there is this layered account of consciousness. The fourfold vision is what he experiences in his most heightened moments, with or without the assistance of plant medicines. I get the impression that Blake probably didn't need any extra stimulus to get there. But then the threefold, soft Bueller's night, this is the lair of poetry and dreaming, where we see the patterns that link together seeming contradictions and oppositions. And then the twofold vision is the state of seeing significance and connection and context and association. And it's an approach to the world that can be maintained at all times, according to Blake. Whereas it might not be possible or actually desirable to walk around at all times in a higher state of consciousness. It takes us back to the state of grace episode we did last season.
Yeah, Peckham Rye, where Blake had some of his fourfold visions, is not the most obvious place one might expect transcendence either.
So, I mean, the warning in the poem is against a flat rationalism, an approach to the world which Blake clearly identifies with the emergence of what we think of as modern science. So you've got the figure of Isaac Newton holding his compasses in Blake's famous drawing. And the point is not to deny that the ways of seeing we associate with science have a place. The point is that to allow this way of seeing to represent the full truth of the world is dangerous and mistaken.
Indeed. I mean, I mentioned Merlin Sheldrake's work in Do Shrooms the other week, and he echoes the same point. There's a chapter, actually, in Entangled Life on the almost infinite complexity of a lichen. And on the one hand, you have a deceptively simple idea of a symbiosis between an alga and a fungus, which is your Newtonian science piece. And on the other, an almost impossible to pin down, extraordinarily ephemeral and constantly changing embodiment of the balance of power, exchange, relationship and reciprocity, which is in essence rather dynamically poetic. So poetry sort of illuminates where science begins to grope in the dark, perhaps.
Well, I'm reminded of something that John Berger said of Jay Griffiths. Reality is such that both language and imagination have to exaggerate in order to confront it truly. Reality is such that both language and imagination have to exaggerate in order to confront it truly. And that's the quality that he was recognizing in Jay's writing. And to me, that's also a statement about the inadequacy of the Newtonian single vision. And so maybe to illustrate the power of double vision or fourfold sight, I have to tell the story of Jay at the first Dark Mountain Festival. So this is, gosh, over 10 years ago now. We're at this venue in Llangollen, which is basically this concrete box of a sports hall that's been lightly converted into a performance space. There's brand new light and sound rig. We'd never run a festival before. We didn't really know how to do it, and it was always constantly on the edge of running out of control. There was a definite culture clash between the guys who were running the light and sound and us as festival organisers. We'd already navigated a couple of moments where they basically threatened to walk out because of people climbing up on the stage, or me not taking people climbing up on the stage and the warnings we needed to give seriously enough, or just generally the difficulty of getting things running to schedule. Anyway, but there was also a clash between the format of the venue, and rows of chairs lined up in front of a stage, speakers on the stage who were barely able to see the audience for the dazzle of the lights, and the nature of what we were there for, the nature of what we were gathered around. And all of this came to a head on the Sunday morning. I had introduced Jay Griffiths and welcomed her to the stage. She was speaking from a text, speaking about the shape-shifting power of language. And I sort of went to stand at the back of the hall and listen and just absorb the atmosphere of how this was landing with people. And after about 20 minutes, I decided I should probably make my way to the side of the stage to be ready to go back on and host the Q&A. In order to get to the side of the stage, I had to leave the hall and walk through the old sports hall changing rooms that were sort of running along the side of the hall itself. And somehow, in the 20 seconds that it took me to do that, while I was out of the room, the sound system chose that moment to die so comprehensively that the crew could barely coax a murmur out of it from then on. I get to the side of the stage and Jay has stopped, but I don't know what's going on. I don't know whether this is deliberate or whether something else has gone on while I was out of the room. Anyway, after a couple of minutes of confusion, what happens is that out of necessity, the audience has to rearrange itself to come out of the rows of seats and climb up on the stage, and no longer getting told off for doing that, or sit on the floor below it. I remember looking down and seeing George Monbiot sat cross-legged on the floor like a child in a school assembly. And suddenly there's no microphone or amplifier, and there's no face-off between the speaker and the audience. We're all of us gathered in a circle around this woman who is talking to us, telling us about the power of language. And I realise that at last we're in the right shape. We're in a shape as old as stories. Now, I don't want to pretend to explain what happened there. And I don't want to explain it away. It's another case of that thing that I've talked about before in these conversations, where it's best not to get too serious about weird happenings, best to treat it as a joke that the world joined in with. But on this occasion, I want to say there's at least a hint that particular ways of using language, the twisted language spoken of by Amazonian shamans, as Jay writes about in Wild, the truthful exaggeration that Berger recognises in her work, the ways of seeing that Blake insists on, that these ways of using language might somehow increase the possibility of strangeness. They might make room for things that don't make sense, but are deeply saturated in and grounded in a sense of meaning that doesn't require us to fully comprehend and be able to explain what's going on. So I guess what I mean by see double is to cultivate, to insist on these ways of seeing the world, the necessity of containing contradictions, holding out for the possibility that seeming opposites may turn out to be part of a deeper and stranger truth that goes missing from our ordinary ways of talking, that language in the way we're used to handling it isn't capable of approaching the full strangeness of the reality of the kind of world in which we find ourselves.
I guess we also see that tension between different strains of what we want, for a better word, might call activism. I remember way, way back, probably 15 years ago in my relatively early environmental consultancy days, when behaviour change was all about switching electronic items off standby mode and doing a bit of recycling and double-sided printing and other rather mundane eco concerns in hindsight, which some might say were actually distractions. And I remember the marvellous Bryony Worthington, now Baroness Worthington, who was one of the key architects of the world's first national climate change bill. And she was ranting rather eloquently about how changing or turning off a light bulb was never going to tackle climate change, that we needed system change, not just behaviour change. And her campaigning organisation, Sandbag, which I sat on the board of for some years, then set out to actively retire carbon credits from the European Carbon Trading Scheme. So they were actually removed from the system in order to create constraint, thereby pushing up the carbon price and in effect generating some real financial pain for high carbon polluters who needed them. And I think that behaviour change versus system change battle still rages. It's another idea of this seeing double. And you touched on this a bit, Dougal, when you alluded to how the significance of actions can only be seen in retrospect. You know, we don't know what the impact of widespread behaviour change or these kind of interventions which are trying to tackle system change will do. And we can't really know what will be effective until long afterwards.
So I talked in the last episode about the economic historian Karl Polanyi and his idea of disembedding, where he says that the creation of modern industrial society can be described as a process in which this thing we now think of as the economy was wrenched out of the social and cultural fabric of human relationships that had mostly governed and bounded the force of market exchange. And then everything else was required to contort itself into shapes that fit this new economic frame. And indeed, we go back and see everything on the far side of that threshold. We go back and see everything through the single vision of this new frame, analyzing the ways in which people have lived in different times and places, as if economics is a timeless universal lens, and the economy as we experience it and talk about it now is a thing that has always been there. So I want to bring in another concept from Polanyi, because this is what made me want to do an episode around seeing double. When he's describing the development of these new market societies that are the result of disembedding, he traces what he calls the double movement, a two-sided process that is why these societies don't simply disintegrate. So on the one side, you have laissez-faire, the political project of free market liberalism in its original flourishing in the 19th century. And Polanyi's great one-liner about this is, laissez-faire was planned. That actually the construction of a free market society doesn't arise by the natural laws that liberal economists and evolutionary psychologists want to tell us explain it all. But there are political interests and processes by which the state constructs these artificial commodities and markets on which what we call the free market depends. And the destructiveness of this is hard to overstate. The early decades of the Industrial Revolution in England are a moment when life expectancy drops dramatically. But something that Polanyi is very good on is the way that looking at social and cultural devastation through an economic or even a demographic lens is going to miss the depth of what is going wrong. There's a great passage in The Great Transformation where he lays into these liberal revisionist economists of the early 20th century who are saying all the people living through the early Industrial Revolution and writing about the horrors of what was around them were wrong, because we can show that the population was growing and the average income was increasing as a long-term trend throughout this period. So Polanyi says you've got this first movement, which is the planned imposition of free market liberal economics, and the effect is a society in meltdown. But then you have the second movement, which isn't the classic Marxist story of the working class recognizing their interests and discovering their power. In Polanyi's version, what you have is a response that's more unplanned, that's coming from all kinds of different places within society, all kinds of different political and class perspectives of people improvising a response to the chaos that the market is raining down on their society. And gradually, out of this second movement emerges what will become the institutions that restrain the destructive force of the market and stabilize market societies into something livable. Now, Polanyi was writing about this in the middle of the Second World War. And in some ways, the decades following that war were the high tide of the achievements of this counter movement, the social market settlement that we associate with the post-war years, what the French call the Trente Glorieuses, the 30 glorious years. But then as that ran aground on the crises of the 1970s, you get a process of dismantling these achievements along with a resurgent free market liberalism. And so this story has been told often. We're now living in the ruins of the achievements of that social settlement. Equally, and this doesn't always get as much attention, even when they were at their height, those achievements we associate with the post-war era were not just the product of a particular moment of history, they were also founded on colonial legacies of exploitation. They were never a promise that could have been extended to everybody else. They were a sharing of the benefits that accrued to one corner of the world more widely for a while within our societies before the retrenchment and dismantling of that began. But what's brought me back to Polanyi lately and to this idea of the double movement is the question of the future, I suppose. Because I had a guy in a workshop that I held last year who said, look, how can I put any faith in the possibility that things might turn out differently when it's blatantly obvious how powerful the forces of headlong, technological, algorithmic exploitation of everything are? And I can see where they're headed. And, you know, he's got a point. I read an extraordinary article just today by Will Hutton in The Guardian, hyping the new age of space exploitation with giant orbital mirrors solving the climate crisis and beaming down space electricity to us, and Elon Musk and the Chinese riding to humanity's rescue. And frankly, most of the things we talk about putting our hope in the conversations you and I have, Ed, feel pretty small and fragile by comparison. So I guess this guy's question is, how do I not feel like a fool for believing that there's any possibility of things turning out differently? And the answer that came to me in the moment when he asked that question in the workshop was to talk about the double movement, to say, maybe that's a lens through which we could look at our own time. It's possible that we have two trajectories, more than two, of course, but these trajectories coexist and are pulling in quite different directions and can go on pulling in different directions for quite a long time without there being clarity as to which will turn out to be the more significant. Because it's not that one of them is real and the other isn't. It's that there's no way of seeing from here how the interaction between them will turn out or which will turn out to be what made all the difference. And so maybe that's another way of seeing double, being able to attend to very different possibilities unfolding and coexisting over time without the reality of one trajectory having to eclipse the other. I think it's a way of holding things open, retaining the possibility of surprise rather than thinking we know how the story ends.
Yeah, I totally resonate with that in terms of the unpredictability. It comes back to why futurists don't make predictions in terms of the way things might pan out. I think I've felt this tension for years. It's like some kind of unpickable Gordian knot. And, you know, maybe the point is you're not really meant to unpick it. And it brings to mind, on the one hand, you have people like my old friend and multiple manifestist, the green marketing maestro, John Grant, who would always say, you know, there's a dark, shadowy and mysterious force that controls the way the world works. You know, it's unpredictable, but when it moves, it's irresistible, and it's called public opinion. And of course, there's a truth to the fact that, you know, if everyone simply stopped driving, flying and buying excessive amounts of inbuilt, obsolescent or cheap disposable tap tomorrow, then the system would judder a bit. But I'm not sure the machine would stop, as we've alluded to before. And we saw that in lockdown. A drop in emissions for sure, but a relatively modest one given the vast scale of disruption, because so much of our emissions are systemic. And now emissions are bouncing back bigger than ever again afterwards as we emerge from that lockdown. But it's also that perhaps that's what the system, consciously or unconsciously, wants us to do, is to shoulder that socioeconomic and eco guilt and social guilt and the burden of responsibility ourselves as individuals, like some form of perverse inverse consumerism. For that's what the cult of the individual compels us to do, rather than take decisive and highly disruptive action collectively. And I was reflecting on this in the context of, you know, some of these big systemic goals, like the Millennium Development Goals, you know, now that they've got the Sustainable Development Goals, and then that's been translated into the Good Life Goals on individual change. And now I've seen pop up the Inner Development Goals. So you're going from these sort of huge intersectoral global goals and targets to individual behaviour change through to now inner skill development. And I can't work out whether this transition is good, bad or mad, or whether it's actually just still completely missing the point. Because what it does, I think, is sort of shine another light into a failure to hold a double vision around what Matthew Taylor calls reformism versus radicalism, which is another of these sort of false binaries and misleading polarities. And I spoke at a Forward Institute session with him the other week when we were both talking about the future. And he said radicals declaim incremental reformists as essentially active blocks to the systemic change urgently required, while reformists decry radicals as dangerous extremists with no respect for the crucial institutions or ways of working that we have. But both of those extremes are a trap. You know, we need reformists with radical eyes and radicals with reformist pragmatism. And perhaps a good example of that was one of my former senior Futera colleagues attacking me for my involvement with XR. And she said Extinction Rebellion wasn't very on brand. It's like, pardon me, but for fuck's sake. I mean, which begs the question, you know, are sustainability consultants sort of drunk on power and money? Are they effectively collusionists or collaborationists in some way, where they're preserving the public license to operate of what are essentially grossly unsustainable businesses, defenders of what is a bad faith, and actually slowing the pace of change by ameliorating the sharp edge of activism? Or are they, you know, the plucky heroes on the inside, bending the mighty levers of power with rigor and vigor within the existing power structures? I mean, I don't know. You know, I think you could probably argue both those positions. And another senior Futera colleague criticized me because my challenges to clients were not within the existing commercial and political realities, to which my response was, well, then I politely suggest we try and change those realities. And I think it takes us back to what we've mentioned before with Vanessa Andreotti's tightrope between the two cliffs of projected hope and projected hopelessness.
I was thinking about Vanessa's book, Hospicing Modernity. I've been reading a bit more of the manuscript this week, and there's a great map in there, one of these social cartographies that comes out of the work she's done with Sharon Stein, Cash Ahanaku, and Dallas Hunt. You can find it on the Decolonial Futures website. And this is a map that sketches out these different places: soft reform, radical reform, and beyond reform, as places we can be operating from, three possible understandings of where things are at and what's worth doing. And what struck me in the way that she writes about this in the book is, on the one hand, it's clear that, you know, the whole work of hospicing modernity starts from a beyond reform position. It's saying it's neither possible nor desirable to salvage, to make sustainable this whole project that we are, you know, the heirs to and the beneficiaries of. But she's also careful to say that there is work to be done from within projects and organizations that are oriented to and maybe limited to a soft reform or a radical reform agenda. It's not all invalidated by the kind of analysis that would lead you to a beyond reform position, like the one that Vanessa's coming from, like the one that I'm coming from. Even if that analysis, that position might lead you to do those other kinds of work differently, with more of a damage limitation approach, with less investment in the promises that are usually made in the name of either reform or radicalism.
I think that's, for me, where my, you know, notorious insultancy style has always tried to sit or maybe squat, you know, weaving those different types of reform, as you say, soft, radical, and beyond. You know, in one sense, I'm sort of working with Greenpeace and Extinction Rebellion's non-violent direct action, but simultaneously inveigling my way into FTSE 100 C-suite machinations through my work on responsible leadership. You know, it comes through with writing strategy and writing poetry, or perhaps doing a scatological comedy podcast called How to Survive the Future, which is based on unfucking ourselves. And then this rather more philosophical excursion with your good self, where we explore into the ways of being fucked that we might not even be aware of. And again, it's not an either or a no, but it's a sort of yes and approach, which that double vision eminently encapsulates. And I guess I'd like to finish actually on another little bit of poetry, from this time from Robert Frost, and an extract from Two Tramps in Mud Time, which I think encapsulates this. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. And maybe it's only by maintaining that voluntary diplopia or double vision, not separating, but allowing the positions to blur, not to polarise, that we can allow the as-yet unseen that really needs to be seen to actually be perceived by Odin.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you're new to the podcast, we'd invite you to check out the journey we've been on over the earlier episodes. In Series 1, we explored the sense-making stories taking shape through the first months of the pandemic. And Series 2 tracked the altered states of consciousness, being and feeling that we were seeing around us. This is an open-ended process, and we're keen to hear from you. So please do comment, ask questions, and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or on Twitter, where Ed is at @FruCool. We're grateful to all of you who've been giving ratings, reviews, and recommendations, and sharing this podcast along your networks. And if you want to get deeper into the territory we explore in these conversations, do check out aschoolcalledhome.org. where you can sign up for live online courses and events. These are extraordinary times, a moment of initiation at a cultural scale. So thank you for being with us on this emergent journey.